Hi, everybody. My name is Josh Nason, and this is Josh Nason's Punch Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. Welcome back. On this week's show, Jonathan Snowden returns to the show. Yes, that Jonathan Snowden, the guy that wrote the MMA Encyclopedia, Total MMA, Shooters, and then also Shamrock, the World's Most Dangerous Man. That was the last time he was on, almost 2 years ago, to talk all about that book. And on this week's show, I wanted Jonathan back because he wrote a very good opinion piece for his Hybrid Shoot Substack. And it just spoke to me because it was all about why he has been falling out of love with the UFC. This is something I've been debating about and had in my heart and head for probably the better part of 2 years. And so and something I was actually going to talk about here in a couple of weeks. And he wrote this, and I'm like, it spoke to me. So I wanted to have him here on here to talk about that. Also, some thoughts about AEW. And he has been a fan since the start. However, he has some issues with basically where things have gone from when he started liking it to where it is today. So we talk about that. And also some new projects that he's working on, including a book contributing to a fictional book about 1980s pro wrestling. He talks about that. And also the unauthorized biography of Dusty Rhodes. Yeah, so we talk all about that and more on this edition of Josh Nason's Punch Out. So let's get to it right now. Myself and Jonathan Snowden talking now. Well, it's been a long time since our guest this week was on and has some good stuff to talk about. As always, he is a multi-time author of many MMA books. I'm looking at some of my newly constructed bookcase right now. Also, my Kindle. He wrote the fantastic Shamrock book, which was the last time he was on to talk about that. Book is awesome. If you don't believe me, if you don't believe him, listen to Dave Meltzer, right? Everyone does. And he loved this book to no end. Did really well in the awards, obviously, and has written all kinds of books. He's written for Bleacher Report and a ton of other websites in the past, doing features not only on your favorite MMA fighters, but also some of your favorite wrestlers as well. Jonathan Snowden is back. Jonathan, tell the good people hello. How are we doing?
I'm doing great. Yeah, the Observer site was certainly very supportive of the Shamrock book. I'm going to be honest. I don't think I liked the Shamrock book as much as Dave did. So it was like heartwarming, like, you know, like almost like weekly somebody would write me and they like, hey, Meltzer's talking about your book again.
Yeah.
So very, very cool. I'm glad to be back on.
Yeah. He would just talk about it. Like anytime anything around it would come up, he would just go and cause he tends to repeat the same stories. He would just talk more and more and more about the book. And that's because the book was really good. You did an excellent.
So it was very like, so it just kind of hit personally for him, I think, because, you know, not to tell tales, but yeah, you know, I think he was, some of the people in the book were sources for Dave. So like he kind of knew some of the stories. Yeah. So, and some of the stories that hadn't been reported. So I think like he had a real keen sense for whether I was full of it or not.
Yeah.
And so I must've passed those tests.
Exactly. Yeah. It was, I mean, it's really a great book since it's been so long since we last talked about it. And again, we talked around the book. The book hadn't even, I don't know if it had even come out yet. I think I talked to you right before it had come out. It was still on your fundraising campaign for it. So in the time since we've talked, and obviously, people have read it and bought it and everything like that. How was the post reaction to it, both from Ken Shamrock standpoint, fans, people meet, like, tell me kind of how the fallout was from it, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, it was very, the response from readers first and people who read it professionally to give their opinion was very gratifying. People had a lot of very nice things to say about it, and so I felt really good about that. Some of the other things that we had in mind didn't come to fruition, partly because of COVID. So we had kind of this grand plan where like Ken would come to like these kind of StarCast style wrestling conventions and stuff like that, and maybe UFC events, and maybe we'd work some kind of deal where he would sign some books and meet fans. And that was part of our sales strategy, or mine, I should say. But it didn't really work because COVID happened and nobody was doing stuff like that. Yeah. And then of course there was Ken's reaction to the book was not necessarily what I expected. So it was an interesting time. I could probably do a whole nother book on the dramatics of the post book of trying to work out some Hollywood deals and agents and Ken getting a new set of agents in between when we started the book and when the book was complete and what a mess that was. There's a lot of insider tales that I don't know what I'm allowed to say, except for it was quite a time.
Oh boy. Well, if you ever want to tell that story, you have a place right here. I'd love to. Yeah. It'd be a great, great book, long form article, or on your hybrid shoot Substack, correct?
Well, you've read the book. So, you know, I'm probably pretty wary of getting messing around with Ken too much. You know, he's not afraid to punch you in the nose, and I'm not interested in that. So we'll see what I think I could get away with.
Yeah, there's always talk. You know, the book is like fresh off the press, they're like, okay, what's next? What's the next one? Have you given yourself time? Now it's been almost a couple of years, give or take. Have you kind of given some thought to a project you might want to jump into next, or some working on something? What can you talk about?
Yeah, that's been really, if people follow me on Twitter, they've probably seen me kind of like pitch to myself and others like a million different things. You know, I've even kind of started several things and then decided maybe I don't want to do this right now. And I've come really close. Like, I think I can say I was really close to writing a book about Mark Coleman, the former UFC and Pride fighter. That just kind of fell apart at the last minute, and maybe it'll happen one day. So that was one that got away. Right now I'm in the middle of writing the biography of Dusty Rhodes, the famous professional wrestler from the 70s and 80s. So that's really what's occupying my headspace most days. And I'm part of a fiction book that should be coming out within the next couple of months. It's features a lot of like real fiction writers, and not just me, but like, you know, people who actually write books, like Chad Dundas, who wrote the Champion of the World book, and yep. He's a former MMA writer as well, and people like that, like actual literary folks. And the book is all about a shared fictional world. We all of our characters share the same world, and it's set in 1980s wrestling. Wow. And so I'll have much more about that once we're allowed to talk about it, but I think that's coming soon. But that was really exciting. I've never written fiction before, so this was my first time, and just seeing how it's all come together, I think there's a chance that people could be pretty excited about it.
Did your first chapter start out, "It was a dark and stormy night"?
I thought about it, maybe something similar to that. And yeah. I was able to, I can curse in it, like, you know, and instead of like in nonfiction where you try to get people not to tell you fake stories. And when you talk to wrestlers, like, this is kind of the opposite, where I'm just telling fake stories, right, but grounded in the real. So, I don't know. I can't wait to tell people more about that one.
Hmm. Yeah. Fiction is so much different than nonfiction, as you know. And yeah, it's a completely different headspace, because you're right. You're trying to get to, especially if you're doing any type of like journalism related endeavors or biographies, kind of like you're obviously very well versed in. You're trying to get to the true story while trying to weave through some of the fiction, right? And then, right. But in the reverse, yeah, you can basically kind of create whatever world you want. It's a completely different writing muscle. I have not done it probably since I was in college or high school or something like that, for some random project. But it's crazy, because people that can do it, it's almost like it's really hard to do both if you're going to do them really well. So this would be an interesting challenge for you.
Yeah, it's been really a lot of fun. And I think it's interesting. So like when you write like long form nonfiction, kind of like what they encourage you to do is make it feel almost like fiction. Like, the famous author Tom Wolfe was kind of one of the early proponents of this, or like Truman Capote or somebody, where it's like you have like a nonfiction story, but you're trying to give it some of the storytelling elements of good fiction. And with this fiction project, I'm trying to ground it in the reality that I would have in my nonfiction writing. So it's the opposite, but also kind of the same. So it's I don't know. I really have enjoyed it.
Great. Have you ever tried to write a screenplay?
I'm actually trying to write a screenplay right now.
Oh, wow. Look, so,
that I can't talk about, but yes, I'm trying to do that now. And it's, that's a whole new set of challenges where you have to like write the screen direction for like what the actors are doing as well as like people just kind of imagine it as the dialogue, but you also have to set up these scenes and that's part of the story as well. Obviously the director and director of photography will do a lot of that imagining, but like you have to put some of it on paper. And so, it's different than fiction and nonfiction. So that this is, I've really been testing myself as we were all kind of, I don't know if fired is the right word. We were all gently let go by Bleacher Report. Like the entire team of people that write long form, were all let go during COVID. So, since that happened, I guess I've kind of tried to test myself in a lot of ways and do things I've never done before. And that's been pretty, it's been pretty exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't, I was thinking probably the hardest kind of writing. It just seems to be like kind of your point of is screenwriting. Cause it's the direction it's, you can't almost just write. You have to think to your point. You have to think about all these different things. It's a crazy skill, but people that do it, I mean, look at the way that content is these days with streaming wars and you know all this. It's amazing how people are able to do that. I think it's such an underappreciated skill. These things just appear on TV or the big screen, and we're just like, oh, they're just telling a story, and there's so many different elements to it. It's that's awesome. So three different styles of writing, man. Good for you.
Yeah, so you know, it's been probably 10 years, maybe. I think 10 years writing for Bleacher Report, maybe. And so, like, and you know how this is, like, and fans feel it too, to an extent, where it's just like, it's the same. You know, like, yes, each UFC event has a different main event. There's different fighters involved, but the kind of has the same rhythms, and you're telling the same stories over and over again. Like, oh, an underdog won the championship, or hey, this guy that you thought was a nice guy is really a criminal and a jerk. Like, you know, there's beats in MMA writing, and I had been doing it for 10 years nonstop. And so it has been kind of nice to do something different as opposed to like a variation of the same thing, which is what covering sports is. Like if you talk about somebody like Uncle Dave Meltzer, it's like, this guy's been doing it for 40 years. It's like, I mean, there's something almost impressive just about that longevity of being able to, cover what's sort of the same thing over and over again, but yet still stay invigorated and passionate about it. Like that's its own skill set too.
Yeah. I want to loop back around to the Dusty Rhodes autobiography you mentioned, but you mentioned UFC. It's a perfect segue. The main reason I want to talk to you tonight. So this idea has been rattling around in my head for probably the better part of 2 years. The conundrum that you laid out here. So you did this this post for Hybrid Shoot. People can see it. Hybrid Shoot, Substack.substack.com. You can all find it on Jonathan's Twitter as well. Entitled, I used to love UFC. What the hell happened? And I saw it randomly the other day on your timeline. You tweeted it. I hadn't even read it yet. And I'm like, he jumped in my head and he pulled out the idea that like I've been trying to wrestle with in my head for like the better part of 2 years. And you go back further than I do when it comes to MMA fandom, people that and covering the sport, people that have read your books or read you, know you at all, know that you go back to like the Pride days, early UFC days. You're so, talked about Ken Shamrock. You're so well versed in that. I kind of came on in 2005, but and people will read it, and I'll kind of go to a couple excerpts from it in a minute that really stood out. But it's this, I have been struggling with this as well, is that like the past 2 years, I've fallen out of love, kind of like you have in a way, with the sport and with the UFC. I don't find myself getting excited for events anymore, pay-per-views or, you know, general fight night cards. It's kind of just like they're all this one like long continuum, and it's hard for me to really kind of get excited. It's hard for me to get excited around the talking about it that I used to consume a little bit more in the way of MMA podcasts, and I used to talk more about it here because I was really into it and really just kind of like felt it. But that's really died off for me in the past 2 years. I don't know if it was the – I have a couple theories and a couple things I'll run past you is kind of what's been affecting me a little bit with this. But I was curious kind of how this – when this idea kind of started rattling around to you and at what point you were kind of like, huh, something's really changed in me and something really changed with how I view this thing that I used to spend so much time watching and talking about.
Yeah, so the article I wrote in like maybe 15 minutes – partly that's just because I had been thinking about it for maybe 3 or 4 years. It feels like, you know, it's just something that I'd like you say, I've just like felt deeply and never really articulated, but I had multiple people on my timeline who just kind of like casually mentioned, like you just did, like, you know, I used to love this. We all did. Like, you know, these are people in my group, my social group, who we used to all sit around and talk about MMA nonstop. And now, like, almost nobody does. You still occasionally watch it, but it's just like you don't have the same feelings for it. And I was kind of trying to figure out why that is. Like, it was to the point with me, like, even in my final years at Bleacher Report, I had just been kind of burned out by it. Like, so I'm asking them, hey, I want to cover boxing too. Mm-hmm. Can I do pro wrestling too? Like, you know, I just wanted something different. This wasn't doing it for me anymore. And so, you know, I had to kind of ask myself why that was. And that's where the story came from, because I used to just be able to say, like, Mark Coleman, Maurice Smith, Randy Couture, Boss, Kevin Randleman, Randy Couture again, Josh Barnett, Rico Rodriguez, Tim Sylvia, Frank Mir. I mean, I could just tell you all, I can still apparently tell you all the UFC heavyweight champions in order. Like, I used to know that stuff. Right now, I couldn't tell you who the champions are, like, in the moment. Like, so, yeah, something had changed, and I wanted to try to figure out what that was.
Mm. Yeah, and you went through a couple points here. The let's see, where the thing – one of the things that really really stuck out, and this is something that doesn't get brought up a lot, was the association with ESPN. And where was the actual phrase here? I just had this. Let's see. So, the truth is UFC has grown too big to fail. The money, even from pay-per-view, is guaranteed. ESPN was willing to deliver it in huge quantities in order to have a captured audience of the promotion's diehard fans as guinea pigs to bolster their new streaming service. UFC doesn't have to build stars or sell fans in the fights. They come pre-sold. The violence itself is a draw, not the individual athletes. People, with a handful of exceptions, tune in to see random, muscly avatars hit and kick each other. They tune in to see someone's lights turn out, or their limbs twist into grotesque mockery of basic anatomy. Whether they recognize the victim's face, it seems it's hardly relevant. That sounds so much like another organization you and I know pretty well, WWE, and right, in that it is all about, and we've heard this phrase over like the past decade or so, it's the push of the brand versus the individual stars. And we've heard it so much, I think we've become desensitized to it. But WWE, I mean, they talk about it on our airwaves and in the newsletter and all this stuff, that WWE is idiot-proof. It's dummy-proof. They make so much money, and it's a ridiculous amount of money to the point where it's like we don't have to produce we don't have to go out of our way to produce something that's A-plus level, knockout level every single month, like a pay-per-view or a premium live event, as they're called now. Or, you know, week to week, we have our 1.87 million that tune in on average every week. We have, you know, it is what it is, because look at all the money that we're bringing in, and there's a boatload more coming because content, streaming service, everyone's in for everything, and we don't have to worry about it. And the UFC has really, it's the same thing. And you point out so eloquently in that paragraph is that there is no... What is the incentive for the UFC to really push individual stars and drive like major big selling pay-per-views? They still like to make quote unquote big fights. And I'll talk about more about that in a minute, but it's so much different. It's the old Marvin Hagler quote about the, you know, it's tough to get up at 5 a.m. when you're sleeping in silk sheets, right?
Right.
It's hard. What incentive does a promoter, an owner, have to put on these blockbuster, let's get a $2 million show, pay-per-view buy show, based on let's build up to these, whatever it is, when they're pulling in billions a year off just being fine. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. And it's very similar. So you're talking about these business models. They're, I don't want to say exactly the same, but they're close enough that at a distance, you might not recognize one from the other because, while UFC has sold to ESPN, to include the pay-per-views, right? So the pay-per-views are now on the ESPN Plus streaming network, and UFC gets a flat amount no matter how many they sell. That's roughly how it works. WWE is in the same business with Peacock, right? So it does feel very similar in that way. And, I think UFC would be very happy if big fights fall in their lap and they can make them and they can make more money for everybody involved. That's awesome. They're not opposed to that. But I think that they are opposed to necessarily trying to single out a bunch of individual athletes and focus all the attention on them rather than the brand. And you can see it from UFC's perspective. Like if you just kind of think about their last three biggest pay-per-view stars, you're thinking about Ronda Rousey, Conor McGregor, Brock Lesnar. You invest a lot in those stars. And the one thing that they have in common is that none of them are there on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And so from UFC's perspective, it is kind of dangerous to invest a lot of time and effort into one person when you don't know. Like Ronda Rousey was the biggest thing going. And then, she ran into some adversity and everything fell apart. You could pretty much see it in her eyes. Like she was done as a professional fighter. Like she could not occupy that headspace anymore. And, Conor McGregor, for whatever reason, the pressures of fame and wealth made him into a crazy person. And Brock found a greener pasture. And so these are all things that UFC has experienced. So knowing that, you can kind of understand why if they have the choice between pushing big stars at the expense of their other shows or just pushing this brand to another even larger company, they're going brand every time because they have control over that.
And to that point, today's UFC isn't a collection of star fighters. It's three letters. That's where they're selling. And that's what you've agreed to accept by streaming ESPN into your living room. And you know what? It's smart. And that's exactly what you just said there. Of course, it's like if they can, and that's the thing in what you're saying and what I'm saying too, is that we may not like it, but they're making a fortune out of it and were able to figure something out that made themselves, not recession proof. What's the best phrase? Yeah. Almost like star departure proof to your point. You were just talking about a second ago that if somebody leaves, that's fine. We have plenty of other guys and girls here that are will be able to turn into something and you'll buy it just the same. You'll watch just the same because the numbers are saying it. So, I think one of the things too, is I find myself really disinterested in the contender build. And I think part of it is because there's always you get excited from someone about someone and then ultimately there's a money dispute that happens or there's just, it takes forever to get the really exciting, number one versus number two to get the title shot fights. It takes a long time to get there. There's a lot of posturing now. People want to preserve their spots because they know there's potential money on the line for them. Not as much as they should be getting, but they seem to be fine with whatever they're getting. And the contender fights, because there's so many fighters now and so many people keep track of, contender runs, they're really hard to get behind more than they were, say, in the 2010, 2015, not even that long ago. It was fun to watch fighters progress because it was easy to follow. I'm like, oh, I just saw this fighter 4 months ago. And it was easy to explain to a friend that may be watching. Oh yeah, this guy. And he's like, oh yeah, I saw him on Ultimate Fighter. I saw this and this. It was just so much easier to follow fighters and watch their journey and kind of be invested in it. But now there's just so many fighters and there's so many different interests involved and so many, it's not as fun for me to watch contenders rise because ultimately it feels like it's going to take them a long time to get where they're going to go, where actually they mean something.
Yeah. And I think there's another thing, an element to this, that the thing that you're talking about here is that it's a double-edged sword, the UFC's matchmaking, because it's partly what we used to love about the UFC and what we'd kind of like as MMA fans would smugly throw in the face of the boxing only fans is the fact in the UFC, they actually match the best fighters with the best fighters, you know, the best guy fights the best guy. That's the kind of the UFC matchmaking strategy. But that can go too far, I think, on some level, especially as they kind of like the time between when someone comes to the audience's attention and when they might get a title shot, as that time gets longer, like there's more opportunities for that to fail. And so UFC will take somebody that fans get excited about with like they have a couple of big knockouts or something like that. And then they'll come into the UFC top 10 and all of a sudden they're fighting like the number five guy and the number four guy and then the number two guy. And, you know, MMA is the way that it is. It's like, you're not going to survive that gauntlet. And so it's almost too much. And it's hard to really for anyone to get that much momentum behind them because you can't survive that challenge. Like pretty much nobody can. And so it's very difficult. They haven't mastered the timing, I don't think, of when someone has the audience's attention. You know, they don't get them into the title fight quickly enough, I think. And I think that's part of what you feel is like there is no extended run. Like the idea of like someone's got some heat behind them, so you give them a couple of favorable and easy matchups so they can get some knockouts and then put them into a title fight. That does not occur to UFC. What occurs to UFC is to put them in against the absolutely best person you can find. And that doesn't always work.
So a few things before I even had read this piece, I wrote down a few of my things of issues that I had, some of the things that I had kind of been like, why am I so disinterested where versus just a few years ago? Let's see a few, too many events, too many fights. And it's one of the things you allude to in your lead here is that essentially UFC in their first, 9 years, put 44 events together, something along those lines. And the last year they had just that much alone. I mean, there's too many shows, especially you have some super fans, hardcore fans are like, oh, the number of events are fine. It's because you don't watch anything else, right? there's so many people that right. we have lives. We like to watch other stuff because, you know, spending so much time on just one thing, it's just not healthy and it's not, you don't want it to be a work. And sitting through 6-hour card every single Saturday, I mean, you have a family, I have a family, listeners have families. It's a lot. It's a big commitment, especially on a weekend, especially when you're watching, a prelim show at 6:30 in the afternoon, and you're kind of, your fam's just kind of like, okay, I guess we're doing that. There's just too many shows and too many fights to really kind of like get a hold to again get behind fighters, follow storylines. It's a pretty big commitment. The other one, which we talked about a second ago, the sport is fun when the Conor McGregors, the Brock Lesnars, the Ronda Rouseys, those big, big stars, the sport's more fun when they're involved. It gets more talk going. It gets more casual interest going, which is kind of cool because you get to hear the sport talked about in different ways. You may talk to your friends about stuff more. And it just kind of feels like big events. I mean, Lesnar was awesome to have in the sport for so many reasons. The John Jones type, obviously, like going back further, the Liddells, the Coutures, BJ Penn fought. I mean, there's all these guys that would, even if they weren't like the top echelon of the Conors and Brocks and Rondas in terms of pay-per-view buys, they still felt like big stars. Chuck Liddell, Daniel Cormier, some of these guys that could headline shows, and you just felt like, all right, this is something. Like you just could really sink your teeth into it, and you kind of historically really felt like this, you kind of knew exactly with a winner or loss kind of where things stood. And the event, the magnitude of it, where to me, you just don't, I mean, these guys are awesome and these girls are awesome fighters now. They just doesn't have that charisma, that next level magnitude as they did, five, even six, 7 years ago to me.
Yeah. And to your point, like, so when we're talking about how UFC had 43 events last year, same number they had in the first 9 years, that's wild. And it's hard, like you say, for a kind of a regular person to keep up with all that. And so what you kind of count on is like for someone to curate the experience for you. Even like, you know, if you talk about like NFL football, like, you know, there's some people that watch everything on League Pass and then they watch the top down view so they can, you know, bet their money lines and they're really into football. That's some people. And there's other people that they just watch Sunday Night Football and they want Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth to tell them, you know, that the good teams are going to be on then and they can kind of follow the league that way. That doesn't really exist for UFC. You know, they just put out 43 shows and most of them are kind of the same. Yeah. Like there's a couple of people maybe you've heard of at the very top of the card and then a bunch of people whose names you can't remember like 15 minutes later. And, you know, it's just hard. It's hard to be a casual fan of it. There's not enough people that Stephen A. Smith would know about so he could yell crazy things. Like those fighters are few and far between.
So a couple more here. I wrote down fun killers. So I was in the building in Boston when Randy Couture fought James Toney. Say fought, you know, because it was the, sure. the famous non-tap, just the double arm wave off and everything. But the build of that, as ridiculous as it was ridiculously fun. It just was something of a, like people in the building were chanting UFC as if James Toney was this, you know, WCW invader in the WWE invasion, right? And like, they were like, we're going to cheer for our group and all this stuff. Like he, you know, if James Toney had somehow won, it wasn't like all of a sudden, you know, this flood of boxers was just going to suddenly appear at the entranceway and just start beating up all the fighters. People were just into it as a storyline and just kind of a fun thing. And we've had these random one-off fights, like when GSP came back and defeated Bisping at Madison Square Garden after 5 years away. That was a fun thing. But they've seen, and this is, again, the stubborn Dana White thing. I'm sure it's a lot to do with it, but like they talked about GSP Khabib forever. They were never able to make that happen. We had some interest with, you know, this is kind of one that really bothered me. You know, Jones and Ngannou, that was some buzzworthy talk. And then what happens? There was a whole, you know, obviously John Jones' legal issues, but then there was talk about contract issues and money. And Jones is, you know, again, we kind of go back to like what he earns. I mean, as far as being a top fighter, of course, he should be making a lot more. And Ngannou, the same thing. I mean, Ngannou becomes a heavyweight champion of the world, and immediately he's going to be out for a year with an injury, but also contract issues. And they don't really go for these kind of wacky, one-off type fights that are unique and fun. You know, they don't do that. They don't seem as interested in that anymore as they used to. And that's kind of a bummer, because that was just kind of when you had this increasing amount of shows per year, to have a few of those a year wasn't the worst thing in the world. You know, it wasn't the stuff that Bellator was doing. It was just kind of just, you know, unique kind of fun fights, you know?
Yeah. So the kind of, I think the thing that underlines all that is money, right? So, you have people like John Jones is interested in Ngannou and George St. Pierre interested in coming back to the sport. And I think what's tied to that for those people is like kind of a different kind of contract, or maybe a more fair contract, maybe more equitable, a bigger percentage of the income. I think that's what's really happening there. And UFC has proven time and time again that they are a company that is not going to yield to that ever. I mean, you go all the way back to the beginning of the Zuffa era when Dana White and the Fertittas took over the UFC, and it's just been a string of these kind of contract issues with their big stars. I mean, Jens Pulver and BJ Penn, and then Tito Ortiz for a long time, and Ken Shamrock upon his return, Randy Couture in a really ugly way, Brock Lesnar. I think, you know, part of the reason that we don't see Conor that much is because it's a constant battle. John Jones is in a battle for money. This has been the kind of the story of UFC and their biggest stars. You know, once they start getting a taste of how much the promotion makes and how big it is, they want a share of it. And UFC is not willing to yield to that at all. And so the kind of fun fights that you're talking about, the kind of weird stuff, the Conor McGregor, Floyd Mayweather stuff, the right. Jake Paul stuff, the kind of bizarro stuff, that's not going to happen under Dana White's watch. If it means he has to pay a fighter a cent more, he's just not going to do it. Doesn't matter if it's a guy he used to manage, like Tito Ortiz. Like, it does not matter. Fedor's another one. They're not yielding on anything for any fighter. And yeah, that's just been the story of UFC. And look, you can't say it didn't work for UFC. You know, guys walked away with billions, with a B, billions of dollars. So it worked for them. As for my fandom, maybe not quite so much, right?
So a couple more here, and then we'll wrap up on this subject. From a talent, I'm going to say this, and I don't mean this from a talent level, but the Dagestani, Chechenian, Russian influx of top talent, they're not as fun as the Brazil contingent when that big push happened and you had all these Brazilian stars and all these different divisions come up. It's again, talent is not a question, but like, again, going back to the charisma level, going back to the interest level in terms of like different personalities, different approaches to the game. I like that the Brazilian fighters, because they're just, it's again, so many different personalities, so many different weight classes. I found them as a group more entertaining when that big push was happening versus the kind of what we're seeing now with, you know, the Islam Makhachevs, and again, going back to Khabib Nurmagomedov and his whole group. I just, they're kind of like, they come in, Khamzat Chimaev, I think, is a little bit of an exception, but still it's kind of been a slow road grind. He had COVID and things like that, but he's, you know, I think he's kind of the exception to the rule. But the rest of the group, they're
so opposite, right? Yeah, like, yeah. It's like you're there's a dourness about the Russian contingent, and that was even true of Fedor. Like, when you would run into him backstage at Strikeforce, you know, there's just never a smile, and there was joy, is how I would categorize most of the Brazilian fighters. There was just like this spirit of joy. And as the Brazilians got big, that was back when I was still allowed to go to UFC events. And so like, I was there a lot, and like, just like the excitement they had about everything, the fighters and the fans that would come as well. I mean, it brought an energy to it that I think, you're right, doesn't necessarily exist today. Like, I remember Rogério Nogueira had won a fight, and I've never seen anybody as excited in my whole life as Anderson Silva was for little Nog winning the fight. Like these guys were just so happy to be alive and in each other's presence and together as they were doing this remarkable thing. You know, it's just seeing them backstage that evening. Like, I can remember the smile to this day. And it's just, I don't think you're ever seeing Khabib smile like that about anything. Like, he's probably never has in his life. Yeah. And I'm not being disrespectful to him personally. It's just, that's just not how he's built. And they come from a very different place and a very different background, and that's okay. But it does just kind of feel different. You're right.
Yeah. Two more. You mentioned this, and you alluded to this in the beginning, but essentially the lack of competition. I mean, Bellator exists, PFL, whatever that is. It's what you wrote here. It's true. There's more groups seemingly than ever, especially when you tie TV deals into it. Granted, you don't know how much these groups are actually getting paid, if they're just kind of, you know, making a little bit of money, what have you. A Campbell's group, the Combate Americas, that supposedly does, you know, 200 million viewers, whatever he wants to tell you. These different Latin American stations, they do well, but they just, these groups just exist. And I thought when Scott Coker took over Bellator, I was optimistic, but I was also a little skeptical, just because it was a different era in terms of what corporate ownership expects from their these products. And instead of, you know, the Strikeforce era, if you go back and look, similar to what you're talking about with UFC, they weren't putting on events every single month. There's sometimes they would take a couple months off. They would do a Strikeforce Challengers event. Then they would do these bigger Strikeforce events, five fights. That was it. That's all you get to see on Showtime. But they were all really good. And granted, the landscape was a lot different then, but that's why I was kind of a little bit skeptical with the Bellator thing and what happens. They're doing multiple events per month, all over the place at different times of day. They're trying to make an inroads in Europe and Italy and some of these places. Again, random times, these they put certain guys in the undercard who I thought they were trying to build up that have names instead of putting them on the main card. And you have people in the main card, you have zero idea who they are. It's it just Bellator really has not come through as like a real contender, which kind of hurts the back and forth when you have guys jumping. Granted, you have the Michael Chandlers, but again, I think those are kind of exceptions. You know, there's not a lot of interest if a guy goes back and forth to the other groups. It's just, there's just not that level of excitement. And then the other thing to kind of wrap this up is Dana White fatigue. We've mentioned him a couple times of this. I mean, there's so many times he's more muzzled in some ways when it comes to, you know, he used to do these, when he was a press conference, he would do the post-event scrum and literally just ask him anything and he would just answer it. And that changed a lot. He stopped doing those as much. How the UFC does press conferences changes. Granted, they're in the new, you know, the kind of the Endeavor era. But there's, and again, on the fighter pay stuff, it's a broken record. It's just kind of this fatigue of hearing the same old story. And again, kind of tied to with everything else we've been talking about here. It's just kind of like, okay, cool. Like what else you got? I mean, granted, how many new deals can the UFC make where you feel it's going to actually, how does this change my fandom? How does this get me more excited and make the sport easier to access? So I think between, you know, the Dana White fatigue, and then the lack of like interesting competition, I think is kind of had two other areas that have really kind of affected my fandom in the past 2 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you made a really strong point that I never really thought about it that way, but Bellator is basically Strikeforce Challengers. Like every Bellator event is Strikeforce Challengers. That's a really apt comparison. And yeah, it's hard to get really that excited about it, but like you're talking about, it's the content business and they need them to put out a bunch of content. So they can't just do four shows a year and stack them the way that, you know, we might like to see. They've got to be putting stuff out more regularly. And so, yeah, it's just hard. I mean, it's hard to be in competition with UFC, as we've seen. You know, we had reported on this kind of stuff before, and now we're seeing in some of the lawsuits and the information that has come out from that look, UFC just dominates the market to the extent that it is very difficult for anyone to compete. Like, you could give Bellator a huge budget, it doesn't matter, because UFC has 90% of the best fighters under contract. So, you know, even if you signed John Jones in your Bellator, I mean, that's cool for one or two fights. And then who does he compete with? You know, that's true with any major name. You'd have to sign probably like four or five people out of a division to really make an impact. And, you know, it just becomes difficult. You know, the challenge is really, I mean, I wouldn't want to undertake it. Like, if someone was start doing an MMA startup and wanted to hire me as a consultant and my pay was tied to their financial success, I would not take that deal. I mean, that's unless, you know, some of them appear to be money laundering operations, and that's a different kind of thing. And the other thing you kind of hinted on with like the Dana White stuff and the constant challenges with fighter pay and things like that is that, I think I mentioned this in the article, but it, you know, when I first started with MMA, it felt like we were in it together. And by we, I mean everybody, mm-hmm. The promoters, the fighters, the fans, the media. Like, this was a thing that we all had to, it was all hands on deck. You had to band together because it wasn't surviving any other way. I mean that literally. Like, anywhere they wanted to go, the local politician would try to shut it down, the cable industry tried to shut it down to the point where they wouldn't even allow adults who could buy pornography with their money on pay-per-view could not buy cage fighting. They could buy boxing, but they couldn't buy cage fighting with their pay-per-view money. Like, so, you know, the deck was stacked, and for this to survive, it took all of us. And that's kind of what it felt like. And I think UFC capitalized on that kind of goodwill. Like, they convinced the fighters for a long time after, you know, Lorenzo and Frank Fertitta and Dana White were making a heck of a lot of money, they still were convincing the fighters, like, hey, we're all in this thing together. It's us against the world. Even as they signed with Spike and as they signed with Fox and as they signed with ESPN, you know, they still try to play this underdog thing, and it's, you know, nobody understands us. But I think the minute that UFC sold for billions of dollars, it kind of like lifted the, you know, the blurry gauze that was covering the what was really going on, I think was lifted, and fighters started to see, like, hey, we're not really in this together. Some of these guys are billionaires, and I'm getting paid $50,000 to fight, and I'm begging for 50 more because I've got a mortgage, or my wife just had a baby. Like, you know, it's a, we're in it together, but it's only when it's hard, not when it gets good.
Right.
And so I think that, that hit everybody involved in the sport, I think, except for very few, you know, like Joe Silva got to walk away with millions of dollars. And of course, Dana and the Fertittas are now sitting on one of those giant mega yachts somewhere, I'm sure. But like, you know, the fighters may have been in it with them, but they didn't receive the payoff. And so I think that kind of has just changed the energy around the entire enterprise, you know, to me.
Well put. And we'll close with close the segment with this. UFC did a fight night event in March 26, 2022, just a couple months ago, Nationwide Arena, Columbus, Ohio. They pulled in 18,630 with a $1.9+ million gate for Curtis Blaydes and Chris Daukaus on the main event. So whatever we're talking about, as we said, they know what they're doing, or they're in a, they're in the run of their lives right now. Cause you pull in a $1.9 million gate and 18,000 people in Columbus, Ohio for Curtis Blaydes and Chris Daukaus in your main event. There you go. You're doing pretty well. So what do we know, right? What do we know? Before we, so, we kind of round the bend here, AEW, let's talk a little about AEW. Cause I know that you are a fan, a watcher of AEW, as I am every single week.
Yeah.
And you have, you know, sometimes we'll share some of your thoughts on social media. And then,
that's always dangerous, right?
And, I know. And how dare you, as you mentioned, say anything potentially critical about AEW, and then people get after you. And it's almost like people don't kind of realize, like, just because you say something critical doesn't mean that it's the worst promotion ever or you hate it. It's just, this ain't working. And I think, last week especially was kind of one of those like, none of this seems to make sense. And if this was WWE, be ripping it apart in terms of the booking, kind of how things came together.
Sure.
And all this stuff. Overall, I enjoy the product, but there's definitely some question marks. I don't want to say red flags, but some yellow flags, I guess. That's what I would say. What are your thoughts, kind of the promotion, the whole, how things are going and enjoyment level and all that?
Yeah, so I loved it from the beginning. I wasn't really sure what I was going to think about it. But so the backstory is that my wife and I have two sons that have pretty severe autism. So we have not done a lot of events, but we were kind of excited, and they got excited about the idea of going to Las Vegas and flying on an airplane. And so we went to our first really big live event of this kind. It was the very first AEW show in Las Vegas, I guess 3 years ago now.
Yeah, 2019, right? Is that Double or Nothing?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it was tremendous. And they had this sensory room for kids that have autism and other problems like that, sensory issues, a special room that we were able to go down into. And it just like, it felt in every way like this was a promotion that was taking care of fans. And I just love the energy of it. It's kind of like a madcap promotion, like a mix of like Ring of Honor, kind of like super fights with New Japan. And then it had kind of like the old school wrestling grandeur as represented by Cody Rhodes and Chris Jericho in his way. Like it was just a mix of a lot of things, and it felt really cool. So that's a long way of saying, like, I was big into AEW to the point where I was working for Bleacher Report at the time, and they weren't really going to do anything about it. You know, they were going to do some things because it was partnered with Turner, but it was going to be more like how we treated like One Fighting, which was also had deals with Turner, where we just kind of did the least that we could, to be honest. You know, because Bleacher Report had tried and failed with every other wrestling promotion. You know, you try to write about Impact, you try to write about Ring of Honor, you try to write about New Japan, nobody clicks on it. But, you know, I worked really hard to make sure that we were covering AEW, and I got to cover it for almost a year. So it was long story short, I was really into it. And we stayed that way as fans. Like, we traveled to Chicago and we traveled to Baltimore as a family. Like, the, you know, after that first show, it became like a thing that we did. And so I've been huge into AEW for its entire run. And honestly, just like the last couple of months, kind of since the departure of Kenny Omega, I think, and then kind of the reimagining of AEW is kind of like NXT in 2019, if it was booked by Tony Khan, is kind of like what AEW feels like sometimes now. And it doesn't feel the same to me. And I've tried to explain that when I say that, I don't mean it's worse or better. It just feels different to me. It's not as good to me. And I'm not sure I'm great at articulating why. You know, I had somebody in the company come into my, we conversed quite a bit, and, you know, just trying to figure out why I think it's not as good. And I'm not sure I'm good at explaining it, but it just does. It feels like a different thing. I don't know if that makes sense. Does it feel different to you?
It feels so. I'm with you in that I was in from the start. I was a, people have listened to this before, I've said this. I was a wrestling fan since I was probably, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8, watching WWF Superstars of Wrestling and trying to get on rabbit ears in my house, like way out in the woods growing up. I had like 1 hour a week, occasionally Saturday night's main event when that would come on. That was my intro. We didn't have cable. We didn't have anything like satellite even until like much, much longer down the road. And then somewhere in the last, you know, 20 years, I kind of just got disenfranchised with WWE, much the same reason that a lot of other people did. It was just kind of like, it just was not worth my time to watch anymore. Didn't make me feel the same. Just didn't feel good to me. And then the UFC really filled that void. And that's kind of where I've got that, part of the itch scratch, so to speak.
Yeah, but I was kind of the same. Yeah. Same for me. You replace WWF with WCW. It's the same.
Exactly. And so, you know, when AEW came along, I was fascinated by it because I was not a big New Japan watcher. I watched a couple things when they did the best of shows on like Access TV or whatever. But then, yeah, I wasn't really big into that. And then I'm like, well, you know, I'll give this a shot. It seems interesting. And obviously we're going to be talking a lot about the Observer site. So, you know, why not? It seems to be interesting in a way that some of these other groups aren't. And yeah, I would say through the last, those first, you know, couple of years or so, the three, it just delivered to me. It was different. It was, the in-ring stuff was good. It was a lot of different talent coming in. But it also had this kind of, you know, this core group. I think I enjoy it still, but there's way too many people to keep track of. And I think part of the, and this is something that, you know, Tony Khan has tried to defend, but you only have 3 hours a week of TV to fill. And part of having kind of a core group is that you're able to, some of what we're talking about, the UFC and what you mentioned in your piece about, you know, the guys from The Ultimate Fighter, the Josh Koscheck, Michael Bisping's, Diego Sanchez, you're able to follow these guys along, kind of understand, maybe they weren't on in a given week or whatever, but you're kind of able to follow along generally what the storyline is. And you get to have more matches between some of these interesting folk because there wasn't such a big roster. Now, you know, the roster is so big, you can dream about seeing a Swerve Strickland against a Kenny Omega someday. But you're like, now it's like, how does that happen? Right. And the fact that they don't have, and this is something I'm interested in, and maybe this will change when the new TV contract comes in. But there's this thing in wrestling now where, like, other than WWE, everybody is working everywhere now. Like, you can see Switchblade Jay White. You can see him in New Japan. You can see him on AEW. You can see him in Impact if you want to. He's working New Japan Strong. And that's one example. A lot of the AEW guys work indie shows. So if you have IWTV, you can watch them in all these different matches all over the place. And to me, like, I like when the only place you could see somebody was in one spot. And that's just kind of a selfish thing, but it made it easier because the dream matches and the matches you didn't think would ever happen, you knew that they weren't happening because there was no way they could. Now there's no reason why match A could not happen if Warrior Wrestling out of Chicago is willing to put the money to do it, and they can actually get both guys or both girls. Like, anything is possible now, but not on the biggest stage. And it's so hard to kind of follow week to week. Where's this group? And it's hard to elevate, you know, a lot. This is the story of wrestling and story of WWE and the end of WCW. It's hard to elevate some of these unknowns and some of these kind of these next level guys, because they bring in so many ex-WWE guys, they kind of fill in the spots, and then they're trying to kind of come up through that quagmire, yes, so to speak. You know what I mean? It's hard. The thing that I liked early was the guys that we didn't know about yet and we heard about were getting their shot. Now the guys we've kind of heard about are behind the guys that we heard about that got signed a year ago. It's hard to really kind of like, what am I watching? There's no like core group. The core, yes, group like grows and grows. So it's like the core group is whoever they put on TV in a given month.
Exactly. And so, like we were talking about UFC and their battle with curation, it's the same with AEW, where it's hard, I think, to figure out what's important, like, because you can't care about everything. You certainly can't care about it all equally. That's why it's important, right, for the promotion to tell you what's important. And with AEW, like, if you think about it, like, you're just a fan and you tune into AEW and you're like, I just want to watch some wrestling. Let's see what's going on here. And there's like a Ring of Honor title, and maybe there's an Impact title out there. Here's a guy with a Mexican wrestling tag team championship. Yeah. They're talking about Japanese wrestling and their champions. And there's six different AEW champions. There's an FTW champion. Like, it is not easy, I think, to keep up with what's necessarily going on and what matters more than other things. Like, when I grew up watching wrestling, watching like Dusty Rhodes and Ric Flair and Magnum TA, like, you knew what was important. Everybody talked about it. It was whoever had the world championship. That was the most important thing in the world to all of them. Even if they had their own program going, they would still occasionally make sure to mention Ric Flair and that they wanted that belt at some point. Like, you knew the hierarchy. There's no hierarchy necessarily with AEW. And as they keep adding people, it becomes more difficult to tell who matters more than who. Like, who am I supposed to be paying attention to? Do I like a guy that we're not going to see again for 4 weeks because there's so many other people you have to get on TV? So I wrote a story about this, the death of AEW 1.0. And this was maybe like a couple of weeks before this UFC story that we're talking about, where I'm like, to me, AEW is Kenny Omega. It's Hangman Page battling the bottle. It's Darby Allin with a dive to nowhere. Joey Janela lighting a cigarette. It's John Moxley trying to bring a serious face to this gathering of goofballs. It's the Meat Man. It's an announcer with a mask on. The Young Bucks doing absolutely crazy stuff. Japanese Joshi wrestlers. It's the first trans superstar in pro wrestling history. It's an earnest Cody Rhodes trying to do 80s wrestling in the midst of all this stuff. Like, it's just beautiful chaos. That's what AEW was. Now it's just like, it's some of that stuff, but all that stuff is behind whatever new guy they signed from WWE. And I know people hate to hear that. And but it just kind of is. It's like, you spent 3 years making us love all these people only to tell us they weren't really that important, because as soon as you could sign the real wrestlers from the other company, none of those guys mattered as much. That's right. Kind of, I think, the heart of what I feel. It's like, you made me care about all these people and these performers and this, the way that you went about wrestling, when it turned out that's really was just what you were doing until you could do something else. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think of, and coincidence of bringing this up, this obviously the Jeff Hardy news in the last, you know, 24 hours, I didn't need to see them sign Jeff Hardy. You know what I mean? I really wasn't that invested in seeing like Hardy's matches in AEW. Like, they talk about dream matches, but you can do those dream matches outside. You know, you don't have to do them inside, and it kind of have, you know, it seems like basically they just had Jeff Hardy do every type of insane bump just to try to get the most out of him before he called it good. It was just kind of a weird thing, but they didn't need, like, some of these guys, they signed them and instead of just slowly working them in. And this is actually, if WWE wants to take advantage of this, look what they've done with Cody Rhodes. Injury aside, he came in, and because they focus on, I think, too few people, they can bring him in, put him into an impact position, and he matters and people are interested. And I'm curious to see The MJF thing has been talked to death, but I look at guys like Hangman Page when his deal is up. He's a good looking guy, well put together, can go in the ring. And does he, are they perhaps in a couple of years, we'll see how things go. Are they like, look, we'll give you $3 to $5 million a year and put you in. Look what we did with wrestler, with Cody Rhodes. Look what we did with, you know, whoever knows who jumps over a Wardlow. You know, some of these guys where it's like they're stuck. They could go over and make more of an impact. That would be the craziest irony of all, is these guys supposedly that were here in AEW to get noticed, having to go to the company that supposedly would never give anyone notice, right? Any type of notice.
It's very interesting because, like, we talk about how WWE does things, and like a lot of people, I find it very frustrating. You know, I don't necessarily watch their weekly television. That would be way too much WWE for me. But one problem they don't have is this curation problem. Like, WWE will tell you exactly who's important and who's not and who to focus on. And they're going to give you a lot of the people they think are important. And so maybe too much. And probably the perfect amount is in the middle of how AEW does it and how WWE does it. But like when Cody shows up there, you're absolutely right. Like, they indicate in all the ways they know how that, hey, this guy, Cody Rhodes, is really important. And he thrived in that environment and was doing so great. A guy that people don't think about going there, who I think would be a perfect WWE talent, is Kenny Omega. I think his kind of like goofball personality and the kind of weird way he cuts promos would be exactly the kind of thing that Vince thought was hilarious for some reason. I don't know why I think that, but I just think that, like, that's the kind of energy that kind of that exists in WWE at its best. And then, of course, in the ring, Kenny Omega is a better Seth Rollins, and I think he'd fit in anywhere. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that you could see making the other jump. And maybe that's what the future is kind of like a back and forth between the two companies, with wrestlers staying fresh by going to a new environment and maybe then coming back. You know, we never know. Maybe Cody will be back in 3 years. Like, who's to say what the future holds? But all I can say is that for now, the AEW that my family fell in love with is not the AEW that exists right now. And that's kind of a shame. But then, you know, life is change, and, you know, everything's moving forwards. I'm going to be moving out of the demo soon. So
the key demo.
I still count right now, but good. In a few years, I don't count anymore. So, you know, they've got to appeal to more than just me.
Unbelievable. Yeah, you'll be in the demo that watches NXT, supposedly the older demo or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That's why I don't want to hear about Uncle Dave so much and his opinions, because he's not in the demo. You're not in the demo, Dave. Like, come on.
That's right. That's right. Boy, that old falling out of the demo comes for all of us, right? Comes for all of us.
If we're lucky, it happens.
I hear you. So you mentioned Cody. Before I let you go, what should people know about the Dusty Rhodes autobiography? What do you want to tell them about that?
Yeah, so it's right now it's an unauthorized biography, and it's a work in progress. I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to do with it, who's going to buy it, where we're going to publish it, all those questions that would normally make me really nervous. I don't feel a lot of pressure about it. I'm just going to do the book to the best of my ability, and then figure that out from there. But right now I'm in the midst of the portion where I'm reading through like every newspaper article from the 1970s all over the country.
Awesome.
And it's really a neat challenge, because when you think about pro wrestling and the history of it in some ways kind of really starts in the 1980s with the invention of the VCR. Like, we have all that stuff. All of Dusty's stuff with the Four Horsemen, the Ric Flair, and the entire career of like everybody that comes after that all exists on videotape in some form for the most part. With the stuff from the 1970s and 1960s for Dusty Rhodes and others, like, you can't even tell necessarily what happened without a lot of work. You know, there was no Wrestling Observer, and there's no videotape to document any of it. So like, so much of it is just like things that an old guy remembers from 70 years ago or whatever. You know, it's like it's a difficult task, but it wouldn't be fun if it wasn't challenging.
Have you been looking through microfiche in this search?
Yes, every day.
Yes, microfiche. Love microfiche. I was talking about microfiche. My wife's niece is a freshman in college, and she was talking about doing some research stuff. And I said, do you, she's talking about the library. I'm like, do you use the microfiche machine a lot? Do you do some research on that? And she looked at me like I had just landed from in off a spaceship. Like she had no idea what I was talking about. And I'm like, you've never heard of microfiche. And then again, I'm like, why am I surprised? It's like people that are just about follow the key demo, like you and I, we remember microfiche. These young kids, they have no idea.
Yeah. And but like, it's the only way, like, you know, there's no online version. Like there's no, nobody was online in for the 1976 Tampa newspaper. You know, you got to look at it another way. And so that's awesome. It's been a really fun to see, how wrestling used to work. And so my plan is to kind of do it the way that the Shamrock book worked, where it's just like, it's the story of Ken Shamrock and this will be the story of Dusty Rhodes. But at the same time, it's also the story of professional wrestling in the 1970s and what it was like in these various places that Dusty traveled. So I'm going to use Dusty as kind of like the focus for maybe a broader story too. And so I don't know how long it's going to take. Hopefully not as long as the Ken book, but I'm definitely committed to it at this point.
Excellent. Well, speaking of Shamrock, you can buy Shamrock, the World's Most Dangerous Man. You can buy Shooters, the Toughest Men in Professional Wrestling, Total MMA, Inside Ultimate Fighting, and also the MMA Encyclopedia. You can buy all those on Amazon or wherever your books are sold, either a hard copy or Kindle versions, or whatever you read. And where, what else do we plug for you? Hybridshoot.com as well as hybridshoot.substack.com. The four books, what else should we plug there, Jonathan?
Well, I don't really do anything professionally anymore, so I don't have to plug anything. So
awesome.
Hopefully we'll come back on. And when I do have some things to plug, please be on the lookout, please, for the Territories fiction collection. Like it's a little bit different than, you know, the normal kind of wrestling book, but I think it could be something really cool. And I hope people give it a chance.
And you can figure out, find out all about this stuff and figure out stuff as well on Twitter as well. Jonathan, J.E. Snowden, J.E.S.N.O.W.D.E.N. on Twitter. Twitter is a love-hate relationship for all of us. So, follow Jonathan for all the hot AEW takes, right?
I tried to make a commitment that I wasn't going to post any AEW opinions for like a couple of weeks. By tomorrow, I will have broken my word for sure.
Awesome. I love it. Well, Jonathan, it's always great talking to you and looking forward to Dusty book, the other projects as well. And best of luck. Thanks again for joining Josh Nason's Punch Up.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Big thanks to Jonathan for stopping by, hanging out for an hour. We were chatting, kind of setting everything up for the interview, and saying, I don't know, about 40, 45 minutes or so. And there was some question of whether we would get to that long and maybe even an hour. And I said, well, I said, we'll get to Gavin and it'll happen. And lo and behold, it did. And yeah, afterwards he's like, oh, I didn't even realize that was an hour. So yeah, that was a good conversation. Hope you enjoyed that. And lots to kind of chew on and think about there, especially with the UFC stuff. And I'm sure there are people listening to this who have felt the same way, and it's okay. People fall out of love with things all the time, and things and tastes change. And you kind of wonder if there's a shelf life to any type of engagement with something like MMA. It's a lot different than, you know, with baseball and football and traditional sports where, you know, your team, especially if you're into the team sports, you know, your team is your team. And unless they move, we're lucky here in New England, the teams don't move. So the names changes, faces changes, your interest level may kind of, sway a little bit, but typically you don't kind of fall out of complete love with your teams unless they break your heart year after year and simply just can't take it anymore. With MMA, and I wonder if it's like this with individual sports like golf and tennis and things like that, where you may love the sport, but for some reason, just the people playing it just don't really hit for you. So I wonder if there's a little bit of that. Well, I'm not a fan of any of the other individual sports like that. So I wonder if there may be some parallels there, something to think about. Maybe some of you out there are fans of those sports. If that's so, and you've kind of felt that, let me know on Twitter at Josh Nason. Also, you know, what are you thinking? You still loving UFC just as much as you did before? Has it waned a little bit? Are you struggling? Interesting to hear your thoughts. Always interested in feedback, either on Twitter or the board, if you want to take it there for those subscribers, and anywhere else. You can also email me, josh@wrestlingobserver.com as well. And let's see, as I record this outro, a little bit of surprising. We're talking about kind of AEW frustrations on the show. And Tony Khan was just on Busted Open Radio, and we listened to that for any potential news, you know, new matches announced for Dynamite or things like that, anything newsworthy. And, you know, surprisingly enough, he wasn't asked about the Jeff Hardy situation at all. And he does a lot of podcasts and interviews, and sometimes it is actually a lot of times a struggle because I don't think he gets asked like hard questions, and I don't even think it's really a hard question. You know, granted, AEW did a release yesterday, being Tuesday, saying essentially suspended and wouldn't be allowed back until he completes rehab. I believe that was the phrasing of the statement, but this is his first public interview since that came out and was not even asked about it. And even if he deferred to the statement as a media group, you have to ask, you have to at least have to ask the question. And I know that, you know, Busted Open, they do a good job, but it is more promotional than informational. I guess you could say it's not really, you know, a hard hitting radio show by any means, but you know, they've talked about some things before. And to me, this is a layup. This is something you have to ask about, just to, even if you're mind, if you're uncomfortable with it, that's part of the game. And you just got to get it out of the way. If you feel like you're that uncomfortable, and you're not going to make, look, if Tony Khan says, I don't want to talk about this, have him say that on the air. Don't have him say that. If he's saying, look, I'm not going to discuss this at all. It's the biggest story in pro wrestling of this week. And probably of this month, and it's going to be probably one of the bigger stories of the year, I would think. Top 10, probably. It's all said and done. So you got to ask. If he's not willing to talk about it, then don't fucking have him on. Sorry, I get a little bit riled up with this stuff, because it's like, just, we have to be willing to push back on these power figures. And if he did say that, don't have him on. If he didn't say that, then shame on you for not asking. Because it's easy to do, and you just ask the question. That's it. You just ask the question. And I would like to think that if he was on these airwaves, he would, especially on a weekly basis, he would be asked about it. I know I would ask him about it. And there's a way you can do it without going on the attack and saying, why did you hire this guy to begin with? You know, there's the Twitter style questions that people want. And then there's the simply to ask about some things, you know, questions I would ask, and I don't expect the Busted Open crew to do this, but questions that are curious to me or ask about me is, what were your conversations like with Jeff Hardy before you signed him? He has had a history of this before. Was it a case of, clearly it was not a case of, what was the phrase? No tolerance policy, or, a one strike and you're out, because this is the one strike and he's still there under contract. What were those conversations like? Did you have? I assume you must have had confidence in his ability to work and do it professionally, and not and kind of put some of these issues behind him. However you want to kind of phrase that. And what type of help are you going to give him? What about wrestlers and wellness policies in general? You know, do you have something along those lines? Something that he's not really been asked about before, but he has all these, he and his family obviously own several sports leagues and sports teams in different sports leagues, I should say. And a lot of them have obviously wellness policy. Look at the NFL. If there's players dealing with drug issues or problems, not getting busted for them, but if they need help, they're going to help them. These are major assets. These are multi-million dollar assets for these different teams. If they need help, they're going to get them. Because they own the Jaguars, is that help, is a similar help available for talent? Is that a differentiator between them and WWE? And WWE obviously has their wellness policy, and they pay for rehab and all these type of things. Is AEW do something similar, leveraging the resources they have as owners of one of the NFL's 32 teams, I believe it is, 32 teams. So those are things, could it be leveraged to Jeff Hardy's benefit? Is this potentially a good thing, or other wrestlers that are having issues with these things? Though that kind of just have a conversation about it rather than promote tonight's Road Rager and, you know, just kind of go on your business and play a game of slap and tickle for 15 minutes once a week. There's more substance there to be had, and he just hadn't said today. Maybe he will in the future. I'm sure he'll be asked about it at some point by people that are serious about what they're doing. But this is kind of a miss, and I'm disappointed that it was not discussed, especially when the fact that it was the tag team title match was discussed, and the Hardys are supposed to be part of that. So the AEW hardcores can say, well, he already put out the statement. What else is there to ask? I just gave you about 5 minutes of other stuff to ask about and talk about. There's plenty more meat on this bone, stuff to understand in a way that is respectful to someone that's going through this issue like Jeff Hardy, but also with a realization that this is a multi-billion dollar industry and AEW is trying to become a bigger part of it. And these are the things, these are when you have to put the big boy pants on. You have to release statements when these things happen immediately. As much as people want to complain about WWE, they are usually with the Jey Uso, which is a weird parallel with the two tag teams that are brothers and one in each team with the Hardys and Usos seems to have a problem with drunk driving, which is really unfortunate. And I don't have a lot of tolerance for it. I have tolerance for the issues of alcoholism. I've had it run in my family before. I have zero tolerance for these repeated offenses. Everyone makes mistakes. Thankfully, hopefully, most of these mistakes don't kill people. When it comes to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, there's a failing of the court system. It's a failing of law enforcement. It is a failing of the individual and those enabling them to drive drunk. It is inexcusable. And Jey Uso should have been fired. And it is, I believe it is Jey Uso. And now I am I'm completely making sure. Yeah, it is Jey Uso. You know, the last time, this was, what, April 2022, Jey Uso blew a .202 and a .205. The legal limit, of course, I believe in most states is .08. He blew a .2. I mean, this and the Jeff Hardy one was just as bad, if not worse. And he got pulled over at 9:30 in the fucking morning. It's crazy. I think we get desensitized to this stuff and you just think about it. Imagine if your family member is driving on the road, going to work, going to an appointment, bringing the kids to school, doing anything. And you have some asshole driving drunk and God help them. You know, they accidentally cause an accident that causes major injury or death to them and other people. So this, you know, granted these guys are wrestlers, but this shit isn't funny. And stuff's got to be taken care of and you got to figure it out. And, you know, the one of the more salient points I've heard is, and I remember hearing this Jey Uso as well, is you have these people pulled over. People get pulled over, get busted. Think about all the times they've driven drunk and they haven't got pulled over. You know, what is it? 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 times? Who knows? You kind of look at the amount of times you may see a police officer driving back and forth from your local restaurant or bar or just going downtown or something like that. And the percent of the time that someone actually gets arrested for these type of things, it's so minimal compared to the times when they're actually doing the crime and don't get caught. So, yeah, it's a pun not intended. It's a sobering thought. And hopefully Jeff gets the help he needs. We've said that before. But, you know, AEW really has to put on the big boy pants with this type of stuff. And when it's time to make a statement, it's time to make a statement earlier and without. And so I was kind of getting this. You know, WWE is very quick, usually quick to respond when it comes to stuff like this, even if it's the basic statement that they've made on like guys like Jey Uso in the past. But at least they make the statement, they at least acknowledge that something's going on. This talk way too long and seemed to be kind of cut and dry. So yeah, a lot of questions there and sorry if I'm rambling for a bit, but this stuff really, it really bothers me. And especially, yeah, just, I've known people that have got arrested for this before, have cleaned themselves up and are good. And then you have other people that, you know, the Jeff Hardys, the Sunnies, Tammy Sitch is the world, and Jey Uso's, and something is broken along the way and being enabled, and someone's going to get killed by one of these people, if not sooner than later. Obviously, Sunny was just involved in this thing. It took how many times she got busted? It's like, what are we doing? What are we doing? Okay, so we're going to end up with a positive note. Thank you all you for listening. Hope you guys had a good time listening to the interview with Jonathan and myself and my ramblings about this whole Hardy situation, and hopefully the media being better when it comes to asking these questions and the organizations being better when it comes to responding and doing so in a grown-up way versus an enabling way. So with all that said, again, you have a lot of choice in your podcast day. Thank you so much for spending time with me or any of the great podcast hosts here at WrestlingObserver.com. And we'll see. I think next week I'm going to try to do an interview, which I said I was going to do this week, but that could push back. So we're going to try to do all that next week and keep it going. So until next time, insert catchphrase here.